Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for getting up early and coming to our second last breakfast briefing for the year. As you know, we're covering the professional business skills and what's the proper title? Practice management and business skills point. So, of course, you're not here for the point, you're here for the content, but just to make sure you get the point. And it's Richard Antill speaking on what to do if your client threatens to sue you. A little bit about Richard's background. Richard, I guess, is a not untypical commercial barrister, covering most of the commercial things that arise out of contractual disputes. But specifically on this topic, Richard had 2 years leave of absence from the bar, where he acted as a risk manager at the Legal Practitioners Liability Committee, and therefore has particular expertise in this area. Excuse me. He, in that role with the LPLC, he was working on a daily basis with solicitors and barristers in managing the risks of their practice, and hence he brings a lot of expertise to what he's going to discuss with us this morning. In coming back to the bar, Richard continues to work in this area, generally assisting and acting on behalf of the solicitors, both who may be threatened to be sued by their clients, or in fact may have clients who are threatening to sue former solicitors. So it's an area which Richard has now taken a particular interest in and enjoys. So thank you very much, and please welcome Richard Antill.
Thanks, Michael. The topic, as you can see, is what to do if a client threatens to sue you. So it's really focusing on what to do if you feel as if there might be a claim out there. It might actually be before the client threatens to sue you. What happens if you come across circumstances which might give rise to a claim? What do you do? And I just suppose I wanted to talk through it in terms of particularly some of the aspects of the LPLC policy, the policy that we're all insured with, that you might need to be aware of, and also just the process that the LPLC adopt. So in short, what to do would firstly be to cease to act in a matter if there is that sort of potential. And it may be, as I said, it may be before the client actually threatens it. You might actually identify yourself, okay, there's a difficulty here. I'm going to have a bit of a conflict because it could be said that I'm negligent and therefore I should cease to act. It's unfortunate you have to do that because, as I'll say at the end, I think one of the underlying causes of claims is clients changing solicitors. But I think it is obviously important to cease acting and then notify the LPLC. Obviously, that's the critical thing, and it's very important to do that early rather than later for all sorts of reasons. You might want to also check the LPLC policy, run through it to make sure whether there are any sort of to make sure that none of the exclusions apply, make sure there aren't any. We'll have a look whether the double excess applies, and whether there's any indemnity back to the LPLC, and I'll run through those issues. And the last one I think is probably the most important is get support. I think the legal profession, I mean, there's been a lot of talk in recent years of depression in the legal profession. As lawyers, we're more prone to depression. There's a focus on mindfulness and that sort of thing to overcome that. And I think the whole area of claims is a bit like sort of a depression in a sense, because there's a huge reluctance, natural reluctance, to actually talk about having a claim made against you. There's a stigma attached. There's probably a perception that if you talk about it, or if you acknowledge it in any way, then that will reduce your reputation as a lawyer. And so it's probably something that you might feel inclined not to talk about, which makes the whole situation really worse. So I'd encourage you to, if this situation arises, to get support, to talk to people about it, and to overcome this stigma. What not to do is ignore it. That's probably the most important thing. Don't just ignore it and think it'll go away. Be proactive and handle it. Secondly, the thing to avoid also is writing sort of letters of getting into sort of correspondence with your client and trying to explain everything, or even, you know, as I've seen in the past, solicitors going on the attack and sending nasty letters to the client, telling the client of all the terrible things that the client did and how wonderful the solicitor was. It's really not helpful in the long run. So avoid doing that. And in fact, I mean, going back to the stigma, the next slide is the stigma. I can say, I'm happy to say, that disclose that as a barrister, I've had a claim made against me. And so I can speak from a personal experience as to how that unfolds. When that claim was made, I did write a long letter explaining and justifying my actions. It didn't prejudice the claim at all, but with the benefit of hindsight, I think I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't do that in the future, just because you can think, oh look, you know, if I can just explain what happened, then perhaps, you know, they'll be reasonable and see light. But often that doesn't happen, and often it just leads to other opportunities for a claim to be established, or other bases for the claim to be established. I can speak from experience. Don't do the second one. Don't admit liability. That's in the policy. You're required not to admit liability. Although I think there's a bit of a tension there, because there's a tension really between probably those last two points, and another possible solution is to resolve it informally with the client, fix up the problem or make the client happy in some way and have it then resolved peacefully, so that you actually maintain good relationships with the client, which is sometimes possible and often possible, but it then means probably admitting liability, apologising, and or perhaps writing a long letter of explanation. So I know I'm actually contradicting myself there, but really it may be in certain circumstances appropriate to do those things, even though it's against the policy. So overcoming the stigma of a claim, as I said, I've had a claim made against me. It wasn't pleasant. It resolved successfully, I'm happy to say. The thing that really struck me when I went to the LPLC and went through a lot of the claims files was that a lot of the claims were made against good solicitors. And it is really a matter of there, but for the grace of God, go I. It might be a simple oversight. There might not be any basis for the claim at all. It's just a disgruntled client who makes the claim. So having a claim made against you doesn't mean that you've been negligent. It doesn't mean that you're a bad lawyer. It doesn't mean you should go and find another profession and leave the law altogether. It just means a claim has been made, and that's all. It's important to be aware of and address the personal costs and not sweep that under the carpet and think, oh, well, you know, I'm fine, you know, it's not affecting me at all. It's important to at least consider that. I know that when the claim was made against me, it did have a big impact on me. It dragged on for a year or so, and it was always in the back of my mind. It wasn't always in the back of my mind, but it's there, and it does make you question how you conduct your practice and so forth. And so I think it's important to talk about it, talk to colleagues, your partners, your wives, husbands, that sort of thing. Perhaps even talk to someone and get counselling, because it can have a big impact on the personal front. Now, in terms of putting all that aside, I mean, then now we just go to the LPLC aren't really interested in that personal effect, that they look at it really from a terms of a process. And it's probably just worthwhile understanding the way that the LPLC process notifications. Obviously, they'll open a file, and it doesn't really matter whether it's a claim or a precautionary notification, they'll still just open a file. They'll allocate it to one of the claim solicitors within the LPLC. There's Justin Toohey, Alex McMillan, Bronwyn Hine, and I think they've put on a fourth one recently. What they also do, and it's important from an insurance point of view, and it's important, I suppose, for you to understand it, that it's important from an insurance point of view, is that they'll specify a current estimate for the file. So they'll give an estimate as to what they think the file is actually going to, the claim will cost the LPLC in terms of any payouts or just in terms of defence costs. So they'll put a current, obviously it's a, at that early stage, it might be a bit of a stab in the dark, but they, the claim solicitors at the LPLC are very experienced, obviously, with these sort of claims, and they therefore have a good handle on how much things costs, and therefore are good at doing the estimate. And then that's updated, that current estimate is updated throughout the course of the claim as further information is provided. They'll appoint a panel solicitor, not always. Particularly precautionary notifications, they won't appoint a panel solicitor immediately because it might simply just be a notification that their claim might be made, and so the file will be opened and then just sit in abeyance until something further is heard. But if proceedings are issued or there are complications involved, the LPLC will appoint one of their panel solicitors to handle the claim, and then that panel solicitor will obviously contact you contact the insured and get details of the claim and manage the claim, and then report back to the LPLC in terms of progress. At that early stage, also either the LPLC or the panel solicitor will identify any indemnity issues. Any issues in relation to possible double excess, possible indemnification back to the LPLC, that sort of thing. And you might, often you'll see after a notification is made, the LPLC just send out a letter confirming that they've received it, the claim and some details about it. And they may well accept indemnity under the policy, or they might reserve their position on that until later investigation. It just means that they're not able to stay at that stage, whether some of the other indemnity issues might arise. Stem further losses where possible. And this is really important, and I think this is what the LPLC claim solicitors are also very good at, is really just sort of working out ways to resolve issues. I mean, a basic example would be, imagine a solicitor who fails to file a defence litigation matter. The plaintiff gets judgment in default. The solicitor thinks, oh, what am I going to do? Not really experienced in litigation. Notifies the LPLC. They're very good at experienced in sort of resolving that sort of thing by, for instance, making an application to set aside default judgment and really nipping any sort of further loss in the bud or writing back to the claimant and suggesting that they mitigate their loss in certain ways. So they're very good at that. And then lastly, you might find that it'll be necessary to enter into a cost-sharing agreement, and that's particularly if the claim involves repayment of some of the fees that you've charged the client, because that's something that's not covered under the policy. And if the defence involves both defending issues that are covered under the policy and issues that aren't, then the LPLC will probably approach you for some sort of cost-sharing arrangement, whereby you pay some of the costs of the defence. So that's that's really, I think, the nutshell of the LPLC process on notification. Feel free to ask questions as I go along, because I'm really quite happy to take questions. In terms of the LPLC policy, I think the most important, probably the best thing to understand before you pick up the policy and start reading it, is that it is the underlying philosophy of the policy is very much protection of the consumer, and therefore it's a non-avoidance policy. And so if you don't understand that, you'll be thinking, why is all these indemnities back and all this sort of stuff? The idea basically is that the consumer is always protected. The policy will respond to a claim, and therefore, if, for instance, the solicitor is insolvent, the claimant will still be able to recover the funds from the LPLC, if you like. And that's, it is very much a consumer protection focus within the policy. And so the LPLC can't avoid liability under the policy because of non-disclosure or misrepresentation or breach of contract by insured, like late notification, which I'll talk about a bit more, or being related parties and so forth. The LPLC are still, the policy still responds to the claim. The LPLC still has to pay out on the claim or meet the claim. But in various situations, the policy responds to the claim, but the insured, the solicitor, is liable to indemnify the LPLC for what the LPLC pays out. Effectively, in those situations, from the solicitor's point of view, you're uninsured. You know, you're going to be actually footing the bill for that claim.
Richard, what's an example of that?
Example of that, here we are. Possible liability to indemnify the LPLC. If there's been a breach of a duty of disclosure or other duty to the insurer, it doesn't necessarily avoid the whole policy. It just means that there's this sort of standard term that you'd need to identify the LPLC for any loss that they've suffered as a result of that breach of disclosure. Or breach of contract of insurance. So the typical example would be late notification. Let's say, to take the example, you forget to file the defence, the opposing side gets judgment in default, you think it's all a bit too hard, you ignore it, you put it in the bottom drawer, a couple of years go by, finally the claim is made, or you notify the LPLC, and by that stage it's not possible to set aside judgment in default, or it's much more expensive to set aside judgment in default because you have to pay lots of costs thrown away or enforcement costs. The LPLC in those situations can say, well, you knew when judgment was entered in default. At that stage, you were aware of the circumstances that could give rise to a claim. You're under a duty under the policy to inform us of that. It's late. And we've suffered loss, the LPLC have suffered loss as a result of that. So that'd be a typical example.
Richard, that sounds a ridiculous example. Someone had put a written a judgment in the bottom drawer for 2 years. Are you quoting a real example there? Or close to?
I think there would be an example of that. They'd be close to that. But there can be late notification for all sorts of reasons. I think a lot of practitioners will see it as, I only notify the LPLC when I actually am served with a writ. The policy actually requires you to notify the LPLC as soon as you become aware of circumstances that give rise to a claim. So it's very early on is the obligation. There aren't that many claims where these sort of issues arise. There are some, and there has been some cases that I've seen where the LPLC have even gone ahead and enforced this indemnity back to the LPLC. Often it might be a late notification, but really, the LPLC haven't suffered any additional expense as a result. So there might not be anything to pay there. related parties. So if you enter into a transaction, if you're acting for a solicitor and party to the transaction is a related party, so if you're, it's a sort of, I think it's a fairly close relative, father, or parent, child, or spouses of your parents or your children or so forth, it's defined within the policy. But if you're acting for a close relative, and that close relative suffers a loss, then the policy will respond so that that close relative will recover in case you're insolvent, but you have then a liability to indemnify the LPLC.
What about related parties when you're acting in a corporate situation? For example, you may be a related party for a public company by being a director of it, or by being a central, or by being a controlling shareholder. You wouldn't want to act, obviously, in that case, but often solicitors will act in companies of which they're directors, wisely or unwisely.
Yes.
They're related parties. The company's a related party under the Act.
Yeah, no, it's same, related.
Does that then mean that you have still have the obligation to indemnify the
LPLC? It's related party under the policy. It's not as wide as perhaps, you know, what you're thinking about in terms of corporation law. It is very much limited to parents, children, and I think, yeah, so parents, children, perhaps spouses of children or parents-in-law perhaps, and then corporate entities that are owned by parents and children. Yeah, so it's not just direct, it really there needs to be ownership of, and it's only to the extent that that related party does own the ownership of that corporate entity. So yeah, if you, it's a rough sketch, but have a look at the policy if you want more details. So failure to report in known circumstances, there's various fraudulent practices where there's an indemnity back. And non-party costs orders, but only in certain situations where there's been some sort of, and I don't know the exact wording, but you look it up if you're worried about that. So they're the examples where there's a possible indemnity liability to indemnify back. I'll just flip back. The excess is currently $5,000 multiplied by the number of relevant principals in the firm, up to a maximum of $25,000. The larger firms will have different, there's a different policy where there's an agreed excess, but if you're for one of those larger firms, you probably don't need to worry about that. And the excess doesn't apply to defence costs. So if a claim is made against you, or you may make a notification, and the claim arises, and you might, the LPLC or the panel solicitor might enter into correspondence with the claimant, and the LPLC incurs legal costs, and then the matter is resolved without the LPLC actually paying an amount to the other side, then your excess won't be called upon. It's only called upon if the LPLC pay out an amount on the claim, either through a settlement or a judgment. Yeah, so it doesn't apply to defence costs. There's an aggregate excess limit. I think it's three times the normal excess within a particular year. So if you're unlucky enough to have four claims made against you in a particular year, then your aggregate excess is only actually going to be three times the normal excess. There is a deterrent excess. It's worthwhile being aware of the situations where that arises, because in terms of your practice, you might want to put in extra caution in those areas. It's basically double the standard excess applies. Failure to issue proceedings within the limitation periods. It's an obvious one. Insured acting for more than one party or interest. Again, it's another. That's a really obvious one to be conscious of. So for instance, you might have a client who's selling a business and comes to you and says, oh look, or, you know, selling a business and comes to you and says, you know, I found a buyer, it's all good, you know, we just want you to act and settle it all and act for both of us. You can do it under the professional conduct rules. You need to follow a certain procedure and get the both clients signed up to a certain form. But be aware that if you do that, then a claim arises, you're going to be facing a double excess. So that's something that certainly it's within your control. A claim arising outside Australia, a claim where there's related interests, a deterrent excess applies. I don't know how that then interacts with the indemnity, but it just occurred to me, I don't know. An unacceptable mortgage loan, where there's been a finding of a breach of professional conduct, fraud or dishonesty, and all non-party costs orders get a deterrent excess. So if you're facing a non-party costs order, then you'll be facing a deterrent excess. How are we doing for time, Duke?
It's just about 8 o'clock. Yeah, good for a break,
yeah. Yep, good for a break, okay.
Yep.
We'll break there and give you a chance to have a bit of coffee and circulate.